This is real free, August 11th. Ray, you have some more on rum running.
Yes, a few little incidents in, up at the, towards the mouth of the Detroit River and down at the outlet where the ferry, train ferries didn't break up the ice in the wintertime when there'd be snow on the ground. Of course, the bootlegger boats couldn't get through the ice, nor could the customs border patrol. So some bootleggers used to get sled and put their load of whiskey on the sled and get themselves completely covered in white sheets or white coveralls. And they'd cover the load with white so it blended in the snow. And then they'd push it across that river and unload it that way. But they had to worry about the shore patrols, not the boats. But it was impossible to see them out during bad weather until they got right up to the shore. And that was a very successful trick. Most of the time, another trick they used, they soon found out that it was foolish when a border patrol boat was overtaking them to jump, just to dump their load overboard and lose it all, rather than be arrested. They had to get it out of the boat, or they'd have been taken in, lose their boat, maybe go to prison. But they took to putting the liquor in burlap sacks, and then throwing the sacks overboard in the shallowest water they knew on their route. Then, when the border patrol would overtake them, there'd be nothing on the boat, no contraband. The bootleggers would go on as if they were just on a pleasure trip. They come back later, probably at night, probably daytime, when the border patrol wasn't around, with lines with hooks, much like the police harbormaster's division retrieved bodies of people who were drowned from the river. And the hooks would catch on the burlap, and they'd retrieve at least part, if not most or all, of the load they'd thrown over. So they saved a lot that way. They used to take it too often. They'd load it directly into trucks and go out. Sometimes they just put it in one truck and take it to a depot. And the next day they'd make their deliveries. In this one office of the depot, there was a Coca-Cola, not machine as we have them now, but a long icebox. And the Federals raided the office one night, and this one bootlegger jumped right in this Coca-Cola thing, and it was half full of ice water. There was no ice or Coke in it. But they didn't look, the feds didn't look in this machine, or this storage bag, or they'd seen him, of course. But it took him 2 weeks to get over the chill that he got while he was hiding in that ice water. They resorted to just about everything to get away from being arrested. There are many former bootleggers still walking around Detroit. They're a little top-heavy from lead bullets they've gotten in chases from the police, the feds, the border patrol, even immigration. They've been shot, and the shots wouldn't stop them if they possibly could keep going. They'd keep going.
Did any go on to glorious careers in the Navy during the Second World War?
Not that I heard of. They'd be a little over age, wouldn't they? No, I don't know of any who did. They worked, they'd given their all of the country, I guess, and supplying it with liquor. Maybe they thought they'd done there. But, no, they were, I know some of those people who tried to get in the service, tried to enlist, and were turned down because of their police record. And a couple I was told just because of bootlegging, the importation of spirits. They finally closed the export tax in Windsor. By closing them, it meant that they couldn't export liquor to the United States anymore. So the stuff that they filled the booth with were marked, you know, Ireland, England, Scotland, foreign countries. It was a technicality, and at first it worried the importers that their supply would be cut, but they soon found a way to get around that by just sending it to another country, and if they happen to stop off in the United States on the way, say to Australia, there wasn't anything in the manifest to prohibit it.
This is August 12th, 1971. We're going to talk, Ray, about the Times City Room.
Well, this was a unique city room, I think. There wasn't anything like it that I've ever seen or heard about on any newspaper in the country, because it was sort of a scruffy country club atmosphere. There wasn't the... there was a very fine mesh, really, of personalities. It was a good newspaper. We scored certainly more than our share of beats on the other papers, and got out of the paper. But it wasn't under the tense atmosphere that is evident in other newspaper city rooms. There was more of a relaxed air. For instance, I at times was a little concerned that somebody would be murdered there, because there's no security on the place at all. Almost anyone who wanted to take the elevator up to the sixth floor could walk into the city room without being stopped or challenged by any guard or anyone at all. And quite frequently, you'd be busy writing a story, and someone would tug at your sleeve and want to know if you wanted to buy a new suit of clothes or some rubber boots or anything, because people had access to it. We had a very well-known and very competent and incidentally quite beautiful woman reporter, Vera Brown. And she'd come back one day from covering a murder of a woman. So she was telling two or three of us about her experiences, and she was gushing about a little boy who was left motherless because of this crime. And the little boy, it seemed, had blonde, curly hair, and captured Vera's heart. And she said, you know, I love children. There isn't anything I wouldn't do for children. Vera, by the way, had no children of her own. And she said, I just wanted to take him home, and what I did. And at this point, about a 10-year-old kid tugged at her sleeve, and he said, want to buy some peanuts, lady? She said, no, dear, thank you. I don't want any peanuts. And he waited. She said, I wanted to bring my son out and got big quart of ice cream for this little boy, and said, you darling, you just eat the whole quart. And, oh, I just hate to give him up. And here his mother was lying there dead, and he didn't know what it was. And he said, Mommy, speak to me, Mommy. And this kid in the office and tugged vigorously again. He says, "Peanuts, lady." She said, "No," firmly this time, "no, I don't want any peanuts." So she said, I all my life I've loved children. I'd like to have a home in the country with 12 children on my own and just bring them up because I love them." The kid tugged at her sleeve again and said, "Lady, don't you want some peanuts? She says, "No, God damn it, you little bastard. Get out of here with your goddamn peanuts." I told you that story. It was funny when it happened. The, talk about that sitting room. One of our big advertisers in the Times, who was a music fancier, called up one time and wanted to talk to our music critic, whose name was Harvey Taylor. Got the city desk by mistake, and the city desk said had him transferred to Harvey Taylor. Now, the man who was calling stammered, and our Mr. Harvey Taylor also had stammered, and they didn't know each other. So the caller was a little suspicious about this man stammering because it sounded as if he were mimicking him. I got this thing wrong. Now, let's start this one again. I mean, how can we do this?
Well, that's all right. We'll just...
All right, the call went to Harry Taylor, who, by mistake, Harry was not the music critic. He was a feature writer, and he stammered badly, and he told the man, who was quite suspicious that he was being mimicked, "Look, you have the wrong Mr. Taylor. I'll switch you to the one that you want to talk to." So he had the call transferred to Harvey Taylor, who's a music critic, and who also stammered. And he got on the phone, stammering at the man, and the man became enraged. He was sure it was a plot to humiliate him. Hung up the phone, and he withdrew all his advertising from the Times, persuaded whatever friends he could to do the same thing, and it took a little time, you know, a little diplomacy to explain that this was the damnedest coincidence that ever happened in the wide world, that you had two people by the same name and who stammered on the same paper, and also the advertiser, and they were not mimicking him at all, but were merely talking as they always talked.
Not a halting explanation, I trust.
Not a halting explanation. We had someone who was able to speak very articulately and quickly do most of the work. Of course, the place was full. It was always had its, as every newspaper office has, number of press agents and politicians and others looking for something for nothing. That is stories, not ads. And the reporters shouldn't be left out because they were the principal inmates. Some years ago, it was quite common for reporters to do a lot of drinking. It was really, it sort of went with the work. And there were no hours at one. One didn't wait till the day was done, and he had his cocktail before dinner, because the day was never done in newspaper work. One didn't have dinner at the same time nightly, and one didn't get home very often for dinner or anything else. So the drinking went on during the day. But it didn't interfere with the work. The papers took a more tolerant attitude toward it than they now do, there's much less of it now, is practically and comparatively non-existent now to what it was like 30 years ago. But it was sort of an all-day thing. And then, when we'd start in the morning, and wherever he'd go, someone would want to get a drink for him right away. And there was so much tension in the work, and then so much waiting. There's, you know, it was a hurry-up-and-wait thing, like they later used to say in the Army, because you'd either be, figuratively speaking, putting out single-handedly a five-alarm fire, playing checkers in the fire hall. There'd be long, long waits, and that would have to be spent, you know, you have to spend it somewhere. A lot of people spent it drinking. Now, there wasn't drinking in the city room as such. That was frowned on. But the attitude in general was pretty tolerant toward it. And the reporters helped each other. If one wasn't quite up to writing a story, somebody else would do it for him. This happened many times that... in fact, there is a classic story of a reporter being out of town, and the city desk receiving by a Western Union three different stories signed by him. And they called him up to ask him, why the three? And he was inarticulate. He couldn't talk at all. But what had happened was he didn't write any of the stories. His friends, knowing that he couldn't, each sent a story, and not knowing that anyone else had done it, each thought he was doing the favor. So they got three good stories instead of one. One reporter had covered a Democratic convention in Chicago, but the office couldn't find him. He took to drinking when he got there, and they were calling him all over. This was in the very early 30s when, I believe it was when Roosevelt was nominated, and the politicians that year were using the term that the office is seeking the man. So when they did finally contact this guy, he said, well, I don't think I should be contacting or seeking the office. I think the office should seek the man. Why didn't you call me sooner? He stayed on. There were... you want to shut it off a minute? There was, of course, a great deal more drinking, as I've said before, than many years ago in the newspaper business than now. But one character that stands out in my mind was a copy reader. He had the one fault, as they say, he liked to drink. But he always came to work cold sober. And he'd sit down at the copy desk, and after he put his time in, he'd get up and he'd be roaring drunk, practically legless. Now, people had observed him, and he never got up in the meantime from that chair, and he never stopped work. It took quite a while to figure it out, but what he would do would have a fairly large, he'd come into work sober with a fairly large bottle of Mystica in the inside pocket of his suit coat, and two glass straws, so they wouldn't crumble. And he put it, while putting his head down over the copy, reading the copy and reading the and writing headlines, and he did a good job at it. He'd be sipping this Mystica. It's a Greek drink that tastes like anise. And it's pretty powerful. So he get up and start staggering around to the dismay of everybody in the city room, because people did not drink in the city room. And it was, I'd say, months before anyone finally figured out how he had achieved intoxication without once getting up from his chair.
Ray, you were pretty well known during your salad years as a drinker yourself. You've been on the wagon, however, for the last 26 years. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, I drank a lot. It was, as I say, par for the course. It didn't interfere with my work, really, because I used to think it was fortunate, but I think it probably was unfortunate. I could drink quite a bit without it affecting me. That is, without me showing it or without it interfering with what I had to do. But it was a morning and night sort of thing, and I was the one who drove the others home and remembered everything that was said. I could work and do my writing, get my facts and do my writing while carrying quite a lot of liquor. It became quite compulsive with me, and I finally realized that I was sort of working for it. If I'd have to go on an assignment and be with somebody, I remember I'd have a debate with myself whether I should take one or two more drinks before going to see this person or going to this place, or whether I should wait. Could I wait until I came out? You know, if I took two before I went in, would it show? Wait until I came out, take some with me. One either was thinking about it all the time, practically all the time, or participating in it. But as I say, fortunately, I was able to keep going and keep my senses, but I liked it. Well, I quit finally because, I guess, of a combination of things. One, I saw too many of my friends fall down, figuratively, and not be able to get up again, probably die from the effects of liquor. People with talent, with a great deal to offer. I saw too many homes broken up. I saw too much suffering from it. But of course, all the years you see those things, you think, well, that won't apply to me. I did, finally, I went to one night to a cabaret that was very loud. It was a Bowery, and I was with some people, and the next day one of them said something about it, and I didn't know what he was talking about. I had spent 2 or 3 hours in this place and didn't remember a thing about it. This scared me, because always I was one who remembered everything, but I just didn't remember. I checked and found that I didn't act drunk, I acted sober. And the people I was with even didn't know that it had affected me. Then I had the experience of waking up one morning and not remembering how I got home. Did I drive? Was my car bumped? What was happening? I had driven myself home, and apparently driven all right. The car was unscathed. I didn't have any tickets for traffic violations, so I guess I drove all right. Well, a friend of mine who, two friends of mine, as a matter of fact, had talked to me about Alcoholics Anonymous, which was just getting started then. This was 1945. And it was underway, but wasn't anything like it is now. They were both in it, and they both were hopeless alcoholics. I thought one of them I had taken to Eloise, now called the Wayne County General Hospital, twice, and I didn't think he'd come out either time. I thought he'd die there. But after the first time he came out, and he wasn't on Skid Row, he was down in the jungles, which is below Skid Row, worse than Skid Row. And this is was a guy with immense talent, looks, personality, breathing. And another was doing his work, but just about. He was from out of town, from Washington, as a matter of fact. He worked for a string of newspapers there, and he was a brilliant writer and a brilliant newspaper man. And I sat up in New Orleans one night where we were both covering a story there, and he was telling me all about his being in AA, and I remember that I wasn't drinking at the time. I was on the wagon for a month or two. And I remember at the time that I said, gee, it's wonderful that you alcoholics have a place to go, that something can be done for you. You know, this is alcoholic thinking on my part. And this is the way an alcoholic thinks. It's great that something can be done for you because you're an alcoholic. Me, I can take it or leave it alone. Then what he was doing, and subtly, was trying to get me to come into the AAs. Then he wrote to me about a year or two later, and said he was coming to Detroit. Would I save a little time for him? And I replied, sure, I'd be glad to see him. But he's coming up on an assignment. So I was in one of the downtown hotels, in a suite there, and this happened frequently, and we had several of us with a party that just lasted for days. And I remember, in the midst of this thing, that Jeebers here, my friend was going to be in Detroit that day. So he always stayed at that same hotel when he came to Detroit. So I called there, and yes, he was registered, and yes, he was in his room. So he rang for me, and I talked to him, and I said, gee, I just happened to be in your hotel, and I'm in room such and such, which was directly across the hall from his room. He came into the suite of ours, and there were a lot of people. They were all celebrating something. And he had a Coke, and we had a nice, pleasant little visit, and he went, said he had to go back to work, so he left. I didn't know until sometime afterwards that he had arranged that trip to Detroit for this specific purpose of talking to me about getting me into AA. And he, of course, saw that I was not in very good shape to talk about it then. Well, getting back to the first friend that I had put in the hospital, not expecting to get out on two different occasions. He had come out, and he had gotten sober, and he had was gotten back in the newspaper work, and he was ascending rather rapidly. Now, I knew this about him, but I hadn't seen him. And he got in touch with me one day and wanted to see me, and he said, you probably wonder why I quit drinking. You probably know I have and wonder how I did it. I said, yes, I did. And he said, well, it's AA. And he said, I think that you'd enjoy it, and you'd like that way to go. He was very careful about, you know, the way he talked. And I said, gee, I just as soon as I get a feeling better, I'll be very glad to go. What do I do? He said, call me and we'll have dinner and we'll go together. I said, I'll do it in probably a couple of days. Well, it was about 6 months. Before I guess I'd reached my own reach bottom, as they say, or hit bottom, and with me, it was pretty much an emotional thing. I was really very down, I think depressed, and I think it was a drink that did it, and I knew that it was running me. I could see that, but I didn't want to admit it. One of the things I said to him, that was a classic example of alcoholic thinking, yeah, but if I should go with you, and people see me coming out of a AA meeting, they'd think I was an alcoholic. You know, because you'd see me coming out of saloons at 3 in the morning. But I went with him to the first meeting. And it was 26 years ago. And I haven't had a drink since. I've never missed it. I thank God every day for the help that I got through the Alcoholics Anonymous, because it's the only thing I conceive of that I can think of that will help a person who has that problem. Now, I did a lot of things before that. I tried, you know, the usual. I was brought up in the Catholic Church, so I tried prayer. I went to went in psychoanalysis and spent a lot of time and a lot of money in that, thinking that if I could get the reason for this compulsion to drink, I could handle it before it got worse than it was. Because while I was getting by, I knew that I couldn't last much longer. None of the things that I did meant anything, but being with the people in AA, that first meeting, they all had much worse experiences than I had had. They were reestablished, and they were happy, normal people. I suppose I thought, well, if they can do it, I can do it. That's probably part of the psychology. But I went to meetings for quite a while, and they were very, very important. And I, of course, got help through conversations with people in the organization. And it gave me the lift I needed over that rough time when I was trying to quit. And I had some rather traumatic experiences right after I quit, too, that just fell in. And fortunately, I was able to handle them. And I think that later years, if I'd had the urge to drink under stress, I'd think back to the early part of my sobriety and think, well, Jesus, I was able to get through those without drinking. I sure can get through with this one, because this is small by comparison.
So when you admit to feeling the urge during the 67 riot?
No. No, I don't think I've had any urge in maybe 20 years. But the first couple of years, particularly, and maybe the first 5, you do have.
How long did you stay with AA?
Well, I suppose I still am a peripheral sort of person in that I've never stopped doing what they call 12-step work, and that's helping others who have the same problem. And I've gotten many people in AA since I've stopped being really active. I think I went to meetings one or two a week on a pretty regular basis for about 3 years. But for the whole time, I've never stopped trying to help other people with the problem, taking them, or singing someone else with them, staying with them to get through.
Tommy McIntyre had a similar experience, didn't he?
He didn't go to AA. Well, I mean, I want to correct that. I guess he went to some meetings for a while. Yes, he did. Yeah, I don't know, however, whether that helped him, or whether that is what helped him. I really don't know that. Or, well, several newspaper people ran it. As a matter of fact, I was the second person in the Times, I found out later, to be in AA by about 3 months. Well, then others got interested, and we had in the editorial staff roughly 20-some people who were alcoholics that had gone in AA. And John McClellan, who was then managing Ender, said to me one day, "Ray, I'm scared to death of this thing." And I said, "Why?" He was not a drinker, by the way. He said, "Well, with all this sobriety on this newspaper, something that's never happened," and he said, "I'm afraid that someday one of you will go over the cliff, you know, fall off the wagon," in other words, although we never called it the wagon, "and then it'll be like a bunch of lemmings, and everybody in the whole staff will get drunk and we'll have no newspaper." But it didn't happen. I would say about 20 people from the city room got help. God knows how many I know, you know, outside newspaper work. That the man who came to, who took me to my first meeting, said, "Look, your anonymity was..." Oh, here's our girl. I was talking. Anonymity was preserved then, as it should be now, and probably is. But I never tried to make any particular secret out of it, out of my participation, because I thought if it's known, somebody has a problem, wants to talk, and if he knows that I'm participating, he might want to talk about it. I'm sure that some heard about it that way and did come in. But he, as I said, his friend of mine said, you're going to be surprised now when you go to this first meeting to see some of your old friends there. And I was surprised. There are a number of persons that I knew but did not know had a serious drinking problem. And until I first met, and then later, other friends would come in that I wouldn't know anything about and wouldn't know that they had a drinking problem at all. And I think it's the greatest thing in the world when one has this illness, that there is this help that he can get if he wants it. Of course, that's a big thing. One has to want sobriety before he can get it. I can't just keep yelling AA at you and have you and take care of your problem. But if the individual wants help, he can get it there. And it's from people who've had experiences that are probably as bad or worse probably than he's had. So it was, I don't know. You see, it's hard to frighten a person. A doctor can tell a person, "Look, you won't live if you don't stop drinking." And I don't know anybody who ever stopped because of a thing like that. But you just got, as I say, you have to hit bottom. And then you stop, and I guess that's what happened with me.
And it's entirely coincidental, Ray, that your last drink coincides with the end of World War II.
Well, I think the condition of the problems I was having at that time with myself, I was out of the Army then, were so great that I didn't even realize that the day, August 10th, was the day they were signing the papers on the Missouri, if that is the right date, I think it is. I know it's the day I quit drinking. It's entirely coincidence. There was no connection at all. I'd had a private war with alcohol. It wasn't in any way connected with the World War, except that I didn't stop drinking while I was in the Army or when I came out of the Army.
And it's been a cold war ever since.
It is.
Sobriety ever a disadvantage in the reporting business?
No. No, I don't think so at all. I used to think so, but that was part of the rationalization. You know, the story, what you can't defensively, one would say, well, sure, I mean, bars and blind pigs, that's where I get news. You don't get a story in church, which is probably true, but you can be in bars blind pig sober, too. Of course, I thought that people were going to be insistent I drank, you know, that I'd have a lot of pressure. And it was very pleasant surprise to find that my friends I would break my arm if I reached for one after I had announced that, because they all wanted me to stop. I didn't know it until I had stopped. And the other people who didn't know me, I'd just say, no, thank you, I don't drink. And that usually ended it. Or if they're too persistent, I'd say, look, I'm way ahead of schedule. I've had all the drinking that one can stand, and I don't drink anymore. So I was looking for a problem there that didn't exist. Would you sit down?
Ray, yesterday we were talking about gangs who operated various rackets during Prohibition. We didn't refer to the kidnapping specialist.
Well, that was a big omission, because kidnapping was one of the big rackets. When gambling was pretty wide open in Detroit during Prohibition, there was a gang that was variously usually referred to as the Legs Layman, L-E-H, I believe, and the kidnapping gang. I see some names that come back to me: Harry Hallisey, Stanley Geelong. There were about 10 of them in all. And they made a practice of kidnapping gamblers, and there are a lot of them, and they had a lot of money, and bootleggers. And their standard fee for releasing them was $25,000. And they got paid off every time. They did not, you know, under threat of murdering the person. They didn't murder anybody. Actually, they weren't rough on the person they were holding. Now, these were not, as a rule, reported to the police. The gamblers didn't want to say anything about it, nor the bootleggers. They just try to keep it quiet, pay off the money. They try to negotiate and get the price down, but I don't think they ever succeeded. And, there might have been some cases that more than 25 was paid and some less. The usual fee was $25,000. And that was the money he paid. The man would be back at work. He'd explain that he'd been on a vacation someplace without telling anybody except those very, very close to him what his experience had been. The police, however, found out what was going on. Oh, incidentally, Abe Bernstein, I remember, told me that he, this was a tough kidnapping game. Abe Bernstein told me that he, when the Purples had a big reputation, somebody interceded with him to get Lehman to release one of the kidnap victims. So he reached him by long-distance telephone. And he told him who he was, and he said he appreciated the favor, and he said, Lehman told me to mind my own goddamn business and not bug him anymore about anybody, and hung up on me. And he said, I did. So they didn't interfere with, they weren't to be interfered with. But the police, as I say, found out something about him, got enough to make some arrests. One of the persons arrested was Lehman, who was shot while the arrest was being made because it was in, it's kind of a rough arrest, and he was shot. He told me while I was in prison that he was beaten by the police with chains while he was in the receiving hospital, that he was subjected to all kinds of torture, and he wouldn't tell on anybody else. But they did manage to arrest a few members of that gang. About a year later, we were surprised that the police rounded up